just live every day, man. Like, make sure that you're living your
Love that.
life purposefully, because if you do that, if you take that attitude, everything else kind of will fall in place.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I am here with my co-host, Ryan Gibson. And boy, we just had the most incredible conversation with Austin Hulbert. Ryan, what are your takeaways?
Man, I think this is going to be one of our best episodes. It's going to be hard to beat this one. I mean, you've got an F-18 military veteran who was sitting in his house in a plane crash in his front yard. So we're going to hear that story.
Yeah.
Then we're going to transition to life on an aircraft carrier. And then the guy went to Harvard and Georgetown, got an MBA, and has a defense startup. And then we're going to dive into everything that he's done in his financial world, all his disciplinary things, just incredible, incredible journey. But Tate, what else did we talk about? I can't remember a couple of the things, but just a mind-blowing episode.
Yeah, just an incredibly accomplished person who has gone through so much and just some amazing life lessons. He's also got a YouTube channel. If you search strobes, like strobe lights, you can see some of his carrier landings. He put that up on YouTube because people kept asking him, what's it like to land on an aircraft carrier? So you could look that up, strobes on YouTube. He also touched on a few words that we want to bring the audience up to speed on so that you're not a little bit lost. A couple of military terms called day trap and night trap. That would refer to a carrier landing in the day or at night. I kind of put two and two together as we were talking, but it got more clear once I went to his YouTube channel. What else, Ryan?
Well, at Passive Income Pilots, we want no pilots left behind. So we start sometimes letting our guests throw out jargon and acronyms. And what we're going to do is we'll make sure at the beginning of the show, we try to define what those mean so that when we're in the heat of the conversation, we don't stop the guest. But what we do instead is later on at the beginning, we'll rewind and say, okay, this is what those acronyms mean. And I think one that he was throwing around a lot was the acronym AUM, or assets under management. And so when you're thinking of AUM as a investor giving your money to a financial advisor or some kind of planning or family office, it's how much money you've turned over to them. So if you have $1 million or $100,000 in your bank account and you give it all to an advisor or some kind of person that manages your money, that's how much AUM you have. So assets under management.
Perfect. Another one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Another one was ETF. And I think most people know what ETFs are, but it's an exchange traded fund, which is much like a mutual fund. It tracks a certain sector, just in case anybody didn't know that one. And of course, EMT. I think everybody knows that one. I'm kidding. He's a voluntary EMT, which is incredible.
And
on top of everything else.
Yeah. Well, let's get started. Let's get right into it.
Yeah, I think everybody's going to have a blast listening to this show. Let's get right into it. Thanks, guys. Austin, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Austin, you and I met at a space launch. We were nerding out on a SpaceX rocket launch, drinking Trulies all night until 4 o'clock in the morning when the rocket actually went off. And man, we just had a great time. So I'm so excited. I think you've got an incredible background. I'm really excited to dig into some of this. But first, can you just kind of give us a bit of your background and tell us about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in an aviation family, born in San Diego. Dad was a Navy reservist out there, flew Tomcats. I guess he was flying F-4s at the time. And my mom had been a reservist and she was a flight attendant at this point at Continental. So we, from my youth, all I wanted to do was be a pilot. And after my dad's command tour ended, we went to Memphis. He was flying for FedEx at the time on the DC-10. And grew up in Memphis pretty much for the formative years. So like last 9 years of my life, 9 to 18, and really wanted to be a fighter pilot. So applied to Naval Academy, got accepted, went there for 4 years, starting, took the oath of office in June of 2001. So that was pretty, different on the time we signed up from when we graduated. Yeah. And graduated 2005, immediately went to Georgetown, did a master's degree there for another like 9 months, and then started flight school in January 2006. Did flight school 2 years, moved from Pensacola to Oklahoma, did some training with the Air Force, then Kingsville, Texas. Then I moved on to Virginia Beach, and then I lived in Virginia Beach for the next 8 years. So went through initial F-18 training, and then did my deployment on the Enterprise out of Virginia Beach and the checkmates, and then went on to become a flight instructor there in Virginia Beach as well. And then did that until 2015, got off active duty, went to Harvard, wanted to do something different and new. So went and got my MBA, spent 2 years up in Boston, had a blast, and really got to peek behind the curtain for how the world operates. So that was pretty fascinating. And then following Harvard, worked at a fintech company in New York City, and then did that for a year, and then worked at McKinsey & Company, which is a global consulting firm, for the last 4 years. And then quit last year, and I've been working on a startup ever since, and had my first kid, or my wife did.
You should aspire to do more, Austin.
I know.
Yeah,
my resume is just not. I'm a slacker.
Real slouch.
Yeah, F-18.
You can tell my bed's not made.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know,
pillows. There's no throw pillows.
I want to see a quarter bounced off that thing.
Won't see that. Well, you got to come over.
Just for anybody who's tuning in, he had to make his bed to get ready for this show. So
that's right.
We appreciate your service, and we appreciate thank you doing that for us. So
anytime.
Austin, I want to ask you. So we had some great conversations on that night. We watched the space launch. You were telling us some stories about flying the F-18. I really want to kind of dive into that. But first of all, what's life like on a carrier? I figure, you know, you wake up, you go get some coffee, go up to the bridge, you know, get some wind in your hair, maybe listen to top. Yeah. Well, you know, metaphorically.
Metaphorically.
And, you know, maybe listen to some Kenny Loggins, and then kind of start your day, right? I don't know. Yeah, that's what I envision. Can you give us a better example of what it's actually like?
Yeah, boats. I mean, it's very routine, and there's an interesting dynamic between the air wing and the ship. So, basically, ship's company lives. So the boat is divided, as is every ship, on, you know, above the business end and below. So the below decks are a lot of the ship's company. So those are the guys that run the reactors, generate the steam, do all the cooking, like the people that make the ship live. And then the air wing are, you know, the business end. So we all live, you know, above, close to the flight deck. So an aircraft carrier, zero deck is the hangar deck. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to like 13 is the top of the island. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way down to 12 is down in the basement. So there's a difference and a kind of cultural difference between the ship's company and the air wing people. Mm-hmm. Ship's company is, you know, they run a different schedule. We operate, you know, we fly day to night, and usually our day starts around noon, and our day ends at around midnight. And for the air wing, the guys that work the flight deck, that's a single shift. So from the moment, you know, an hour, however long before the first launch, you've got guys up there turning wrenches, getting the aircraft ready, and they do not leave that flight deck until all the jets are put to bed at the end of the night. They eat their meals up there. They go to the bathroom up there. Everything is done on the flight deck. So that's kind of how the air wings, the life goes around. So you build a routine around that. And, you know, mornings for us, we wake up at the crack of 11 o'clock-ish, and then, you know, go take our morning shower and walk around the boat in our, you know, bathrobes. And meanwhile, the ship's company there, they've been awake since 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And they just look at us like we're all, you know, lazy because we just sleep until 11. So there's always this drama between ship's company and air wing. And they just think we're slackers.
It's not that different to an airline.
Yeah, kind of, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. So there's this like cultural difference between it. And obviously the pilots like encourage that and are like, yeah, we've totally been sleeping till 11 and we don't do anything else other than sleep. But really like the day starts at 11. You go get lunch, it was breakfast. And then, you know, if you're on the flight schedule, you'll start, or, you know, you also have ground jobs. So the entire squadron, the Navy squadron has, you know, around 12 to 14 aircraft. Typically you'll have around 14 to 16 pilots ish. front seaters. And then if you're a two seater, you'll have the back seat guys equal number. And then you have the troops. There's about 220 people who do all the maintenance, the engines. And so the officers run those different shops. So you'll be going out to your shops, checking on your guys, you know, writing evals, doing paperwork for them, checking their health and welfare. And then you'll be doing mission planning, studying for upgrades. So there's always a lot of stuff to do during the day. So if you're not flying, you're usually tackling one of those things on your to-do list. And then, you know, dinner is lunch. And then at the end of the flight day, after midnight, you know, most aviators, a lot of people will, you know, adopt device, the, you know, smoking on deployment just because it's the only way you can get a high on the boat. So, at, you know, at the end of the night, usually you'll get out in the smoke pit, grab a cigarette with your maintenance guys, you know, one or two, and then everyone goes down to eat dinner, which is mid-rats, and that's usually breakfast meal. So eggs, hash browns, and you just sit down in the wardroom until like midnight, 1:30, 2, then maybe go back, do a little bit more work. Sometimes we'll have a movie showing in the evening. And then most guys go to bed around like 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
That's interesting. And
you just start the cycle again. So it's very routine based. You know, at some point in there, you know, you'll have little groups and you'll go to the gym. So, you know, you'll find the CrossFit guys, they'll go down to the hangar deck and they'll do CrossFit. You'll have the runners, they'll run up to the treadmill and run all day. So you find your kind of clique for people you want to do certain things with. And then there's also just nice little moments of kind of alone time, you know, sitting out on the fantail. And in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, you can see every single star, no light pollution at all. So it's pretty nice to go out there on a, you know, no moon night with no clouds and just like sit there. So you'll see people just kind of sitting around, just soaking up life. And so you see like little slivers of normalcy in an otherwise abnormal world.
What did you like most about it? What was your like, I really miss being on a ship for this reason?
The flying was awesome. Day traps are unbeatable, but the camaraderie too. I think there's a lot of that that's kind of going, it's changing now. When I deployed, we didn't have Wi-Fi on the ship. We just had, you know, three computers that everyone had to share. So basically we're still, you know, I still wrote letters. We still received care packages. And when you're down at dinner, you're just talking and hanging out and just shooting the shit. So, you know, no one carried cell phones. No one was distracted by social media. It was just real human interactions. And I think that level of camaraderie is what you like. That's what you get on deployments, is that close personal connection. And that was, you know, in a time where technology was taking over, it was nice to have that respite, to fly away from the beach, see your signal gone, and then just throw your phone in your room for 4 months and never have to do that again. And then the flying obviously is just, there's no rules. There's a few rules within 10 miles of the ship, but it's see and avoid. And it's kind of cowboy country. And then landing on the boat is obviously, during the daytime, it's fun. No other way to describe it.
That's amazing. What's the one thing that you never want to do again?
Night traps, night landings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's got
to
be
the first time you do it. You're like, okay, that wasn't bad. The second time, now you know what to expect, and it's just not. I don't know many people that, and I don't know anyone who enjoys landing on the boat at night, because it's just, it's not fun. It's scary.
And that runway is what, 300 feet long?
There's 40 feet between the cables. So, you know, there's four on the older boats, there's four cables, the newer boats, there's three cables. So cable to cable, you only have 80 feet. Well, you tack another 40 feet in front of the one wire. So you have, you know, 120 feet to with that where you want to land. And then the whole area, I think, is like 500, 50, 600 feet long, but you don't want to be using anything outside that 120 feet because you're either really low and about to hit the back of the ship, or you've gone really long and that presents its own challenges. So you're really targeting that 120 foot area. You have to fly the tail hook essentially between a strike zone in order to hit it, just at the speed you're going, because your approach speed is 134 knots in the Super Hornet. So at that speed, you know, a little high, a couple feet high, and you're going around, you're missing all those wires.
Amazing. So tell us a little bit more about the flying stories. I mean, we talked about the life on the carrier and, but yeah, man. What, give us some flying stories, because that's what everybody wants to hear, right?
Oh man, there's so many. Let's see. You want like the almost died story, or
yeah?
So I was instructing. This is probably the worst day. I was instructing a student in BFM, and we were in this like two circle engagement, right? So I'm the instructor in the back seat of the lead jet, and the instructor's behind us, instructor pilot, and he's you know, at our six, and the student's like, I don't know what to do. We're at like 10,000 feet, right? And I go, all right, what do you do when someone's at this corner? Like, you need to break into them and defeat the shot, blah, blah, blah. So talk him through that and then have him redefine the fight and go nose low and try to, you know, get angles on the bandit, break out of this defensive BFM scenario. So he ditches and goes low, and then he ditches and goes low again. And now you're supposed to just make for the hard deck. So the hard deck, 5,000 feet. So he's supposed to transition and just like level off at 5,000 and pretend that he's right above the trees now, and then try to kill the guy who's killing us. But he doesn't, and he decides to dive down again. And at this point, he had been an afterburner for both of those two. I mean, this is a student. This is like the third time he's done this. So we're now, he redefines, we're 55 degrees nose low. We're at 5,000 feet doing 550 knots. And the reason I remember this is I press pause when we pulled the tapes, and it was all nickels, right? Just fives across the board. And so in real time, I just, you know, my heart just stops and I just start screaming, pull up, pull up. And he eventually like grabs the override switch and pulls back. We scoop it out with about 1,000 to 700 feet, I think it was, at, you know, doing 500 something inch knots. And then we got, you know, we level off, climb back up, and he doesn't know exactly how bad it is. He's like, hey, what are we setting up for the next one? I'm like, nah, dude, we're going home. Let's get out of here. So we go home, land, show him the tapes, and he comes in, and I just have him sit down and say, hey, what, read to me these parameters. Where are we? And he reads them. And once he finishes, his face just went ghost white. And I said, yeah, do you think you would have lived today? You think you'd be alive right now if someone hadn't been in your backseat? He was like, no. I'm like, cool. Like, I don't need to beat you about this. I don't need to yell at you about this. Like, you just learned the lesson, because the blood left his face, and the blood left my face back in the jet. So afterwards, I just went and grabbed a beer and went home, and I said, hey man, you're going to be on the bench for a couple of days. Just relax. Everyone has these moments. You're going to learn from it. You're going to become a better pilot. Let's focus on the other parts of the flight. So, you know, it's one of those flight instructions, you know, I always hated the instructors who just like kept going and beating the dead horse. I'm like, yeah, I got it, dude. Like, you told me in the airplane, you told me in the debrief, and now you're telling me, like, I got it. I messed up. So I always tried to not be that instructor. But yeah, that kid was, he graduated, did just fine, went on, very successful guy, but that was probably the scariest I've ever been. I mean, we ended up, if we had waited, I think it was like 0.6 seconds, we wouldn't have survived.
Wow. That's amazing. So,
yeah. I had another fun, the day I checked into my unit, my house is on the extended center line of the runway. So I was just talking to the boss. I was like, hey, new instructor, blah, blah, blah. He's like, cool. You know, we'll try to get you on the flights flying here soon. So it was my check-in. Went home. I was like, cool. It's like 11. I'm going to go home and take the rest of the day off. So I went home, went up in my living room, and then I heard this like, I'm like, oh man, someone's low. And then I got a text message like maybe a minute later from my friend saying, hey, a jet just crashed. I'm like, no shit. I'm like, yeah, right next to your house. And I go to the window and open the blinds, and it's just flame, like fire just billowing out. And at the time I was an EMT in Virginia Beach. So I just went and down, got in my car, drove to the station, grabbed an ambulance, went straight to the scene. And then it was just absolute carnage. This Hornet had lost an engine on takeoff. And so the pilot thought he had a FOD ingestion. So he pulled the throttles out of afterburner. And then it wasn't a FOD ingestion. It was just the engine had shit itself. So when he realized he lost an engine, he went back into burner, but the jet malfunctioned again. And when you go into afterburner, the cans are supposed to open up because you're putting out so much thrust that the only way is for the nozzles to open, which is why you see them open in the movies. But when you go to mill, the nozzles close because of the Venturi effect. So basically those nozzles, when he selected afterburner, opened back up, but the afterburner didn't start. So he was still in mill. And then the nozzles opened up. So now the jet just lost a bunch more thrust. So basically he got airborne and then just settled right down and plowed into an apartment complex. It was a retirement home.
Oh my God.
With like 50 something, people landed right on top, like right in the middle of a couple buildings, and just the fireball fully loaded just blasted all these buildings around. It ended up destroying like 56 apartments. But it's called the Good Friday Miracle because not a single person in this entire retirement home was inside their apartment.
Wow.
So it wiped out, and you can Google this. It happened in 2012, Good Friday Miracle. And it's just, the photos are insane, but we had stacks of body bags, and not even a pet died, like not even the dog or a cat or parakeet. Wow. Yeah.
Speaking of being a slouch, you're an EMT also?
Yeah, I was an EMT for 7 years. I did it volunteer wise. My family's in a bad car wreck when I was in college. So I always wanted to pay it forward. And, you know, the people who saved my dad's life were EMTs and my brother's life. So I decided I would do that. And after I graduated, I became an EMT. And then I talked to my boss when I was in my unit. And I was like, hey, sir, I volunteer. It's like 48 hours a month that I ride the ambulance. Like, do you mind if I, you know, show up late to work on Monday so I can do a Sunday night shift? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. So I would just do ambulance on the weekends every once in a while.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Awesome. It was fun.
Yeah. It was such great experience. And, you know, going from Georgetown to F-18 school to being going back to Harvard to being an EMT, very impressive. And you know, I'm very interested in pulling on a lot of threads. But what is your why? What's making you, what's driving you? What's kind of your value set? Because obviously you seem like a very disciplined, focused person with a multitude of things that you get yourself into. You know, what's your purpose? What's your what do you want to leave in this lifetime?
So, I mean, a little bit of that's, you know, firstborn kid, right? Like, you know, always more, whatever, goal seeking, whatever it is. But for me, the transformative event was my freshman year of college. Right after our plebe summer, parents come up to visit and they get to see you after your military transformation, whatever. And on the way home, my parents got in a car wreck, a Ford Explorer rollover, and my mom was killed. My dad was in a coma. He actually died in the hospital. My brother was banged up real bad. So my mom died on the scene. And so, you know, when I got to the hospital eventually, they told me, you know, I had to go bury my mom. The day I got back from burying my mom, my dad was in a coma. And they were like, hey, your father's brain dead. He's never going to wake up out of this coma. So you need to decide when you want to pull the plug. And I was like wrecked. Like, it was definitely the bottom part of my life. Still get choked up to this day. But I was like, okay, well, I need to make the best of this. I need to just go through it. And my dad woke. I said, hey, I'm not going to pull a plug anytime soon. Like, let's cool your jets, bro. I just buried my mom. Like, give me a couple minutes here. And my dad just woke up. Like, blew the neurosurgeons away. He went from zero brain activity to just, he opened his eyes one day and he wasn't talking because he had a feeding tube in. So we did the POW code of the alphabet on like the 5x5, and he would squeeze one hand for the row and the other hand for the column. So he could like spell out some words. But I never talked to him for 4 or 5 months because he had the feeding tube in, and learned how to walk again. He had lost both lungs were punctured. He lost 3 vertebrae crushed, 7 more broken. And you know, a year later, he was flying a FedEx. Like, so dude's a machine. But basically, I was like, life is short and this could end at any moment. And I want to get like every drop I can get out of life. And so that was kind of that's been my motivator ever since, was I want to have as many friends as I can have. I want to have as many experiences as I can have. And I want to ride it in with no gas, you know, tires burned out.
Yes.
And just squeeze as much as I can out of this life, because it truly is fleeting. Like, and that's been my philosophy. In a way, it's been it was a blessing and a curse. Like, I don't know if I would have achieved the things I've achieved had I not had that lesson. And the sad part is that lesson is, it's so cliche, right? Everybody knows that. Oh, live every day if it's your last. Like, you never know what it ends. And it goes in one ear and out one other, and people don't realize it. And even I have to remind myself, like, hey, this, I'm glad to be here. I'm lucky to be alive. What are you doing to make your life even better and enhance the lives of the people around you? So that's kind of been how I've approached my life and why I've been able to, I guess, go after relentlessly all these different things. I've also failed a lot too. So don't forget that.
Yeah. Just highlighting that very challenging event in your life. What got you through it? I mean, that's not something that you can just, what helped you get through that challenging time and get back on your feet? That's pretty intense.
Friends and support network. So my dad was obviously pilot of FedEx at the time. I found out about this after the fact, but after the wreck had happened, Fred Smith had been told, hey, one of your pilots, his family just got in this bad car wreck. And he told them to send the corporate jet to pick me up in Annapolis to get me home faster. The Navy, of course, was like, no, we'll take out a loan on his behalf and buy a last minute plane ticket for him, and he can pay us back in a year. So,
wow.
Thanks, Navy.
Wow.
But, you know, when I got there, there was the Union, the ALPA was there. My dad's Navy network showed up in force. My mom's network obviously overlapped with that. Like, We had friends out the wazoo showing up, supporting us. And it just showed me the power of like meaningful, true friendships, of dropping whatever you'll do to go help someone. And that, you know, that experience showed me to really be genuine. And I haven't always done the right things with friends, right? Like all of us fuck up friendships. And, but you know, over the time that makes for stronger friendships and the lessons learned take to doing that. And, you know, I just had the network around me was just so amazing. People just came out of the woodwork. When this happened, it was in Tupelo, Mississippi, and it was Elvis's birth weekend. He was born in Tupelo. So like all the Elvis nuts go down there and like rent all the hotels. So there are no hotels. I was sleeping in the ICU, like just in the little like lobby area in my uniform. And this retirement home found out about it. And they reached out to the hospital and said, hey, tell him we have an extra room in this assisted living facility. He can come live with us. And the retirement facility just hosted me and let me stay there. And we were based out of there for a little bit while we were caring for my dad, and my brother. So just all these people I didn't even know are coming out helping. And that was kind of the, you know, the impetus for me becoming an EMT was, you know, all these strangers just dropped what they were doing and helped us out. And people we knew, people we didn't know. And I was like, people matter more than anything else.
That's so amazing. I remember actually, the critical incident response team is something that I was involved in with ELPA for a couple of years that, you know, probably I would imagine jumped in and really paid dividends. And volunteering for stuff like that is just really critical because of your situation and the support that it can provide people, in addition to your friendships and all the things that were otherwise extended to you.
Yeah.
I wanted to, you know, the reason why we do this show is we want to help aviators be more successful in life, in finances. You know, we want to bring on guests that can share stuff. And obviously your background is very fitting for our audience. I'd like to switch gears a little bit and just talk about, you know, your startup, maybe some of your financial journey things. I mean, obviously being a Harvard Business School grad, Georgetown, getting into business, getting into startups. You know, I want to talk about maybe some habits that you have or some knowledge that you want to impart on our listeners that would help them sort of structure those types of things or give thought to some things that they might be thinking about doing, like investing or just restructuring their life in a way that gives them some of those freedoms.
Yeah. So as with a lot of pilots, like when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was be a pilot. So when I got accepted to Harvard, I didn't know what a stock was. I knew what a stock was. I didn't know what a bond was. I don't know what a mutual fund is. Roth 401k. Like, I don't know what any of this shit is, right? Like, I have the IRA and I'm supposed to put X number of dollars every year, and I don't know what to do with that. So really financially illiterate, really illiterate. And obviously, like, corrected that problem as Harvard does. And I interned for my summer at Goldman Sachs and did investment management. And I saw how the ultra wealthy, like 20 million assets under management and up crowd, how they manage stuff. And I think there's a lot that resonates, you know, from a pilot point of view. We pilots tend to think we're gods, right? We're the best at everything we do. You know, like, I'll be the best boat driver, right? Put me on that wake tube. I won't fall off. Like, I'm the best at everything. That we're just like the best investors.
There's 330 million Americans in the United States, and there's only like 100,000 airline pilots. So what do you mean? Of course we're the best, right?
Cream of the crop.
Yeah. We all think we're Sully and we can just nail everything. And but in reality, it's not true, right? Like, we're also the first people to point out when someone's like, you know, some dentist is like, oh, I'm a pilot too. And you're like, yeah, no, you're not. You're not a pilot. If you have a private pilot's license, you're not a pilot. And so why would we have the hubris to think that all of a sudden we're investing professionals, right? So if I'm the first one to point out that, you know, someone with a PPL is not a pilot, I don't do that because I think they're our pilots. Like, congratulations. Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
like, they're not professionals and I'm not an investment professional. I should leave it to the professionals. And what I saw at Harvard was like, most pilots don't realize this. There are people, I mean, people know that, yeah, investment bankers, they make millions of dollars. People at hedge fund make, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars a year. They make millions and millions and millions of dollars a year building Excel models, going through people's garbage, like piecing together pieces of shredded paper so they can gain an edge when a hedge fund is like trying to buy out and take a position on something and short a company, they're dumpster diving. They are building insane financial models. And for you to think that you can like look at a chart and be smarter than these dudes, all of whom have Ivy League degrees and have been doing this, have gone through like three or four marriages in order to get to where they're making $10, $20 million a year. And they have, you know, their net worth is hundreds of millions of dollars. Like, you think you can do better than these guys? Like, that's no. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway that I had is like, stop trying to go after individual stocks. You know, you need to be, at a most like sector investing. You know, if you see the, you know, like oil and gas during COVID, right? Like was getting its you know, face punched in. That would be a good time to buy into the oil and gas sector. But by and large, we shouldn't be making, you know, one-off bets. You know, we shouldn't be YOLOing AMC stock or like throwing everything into Bitcoin because there's just more sophisticated people getting paid a lot more money to be smarter than all of us on that. And they're being paid not only to be smarter than us, than to be smarter than other people getting paid millions of dollars doing the exact same thing. And they only have to be right 51% of the time to become really, really rich. So, you know, I'm of the opinion, like leave it to the, and it's tempting, right? Like I'm not perfect. I have made some one-off investments. Some of those have done well, some of them haven't. But you know, the investing I do now, all my new money just goes straight into ETFs because I don't have the time. Like I've got other shit I need to do. Like I don't have the time to draw out some investment thesis about why we should go into a particular stock. Like I would rather just buy an ETF for the S&P or just put my stuff into, you know, some sector that I think is undervalued. But yeah, leave it to the professionals.
So as a follow-up on that, I mean, I think we're gonna get to real estate and alternatives and all that stuff. But you know, what can you tell us in terms of like where the rubber meets the road? You know, when someone has a $20 million plus assets under management with Goldman, and they're trusting the professionals, like what does that actually look like from a day to day? Like if someone who's high, like ultra high net worth, versus Joe Pilot, who has his 401k, how are those different? And how can, you know, a pilot who is, you know, got a great career, high paying, whatever, by, you know, middle-class standards, effectuate that on a day-to-day?
The biggest thing is the team and the support that goes behind it, right? So you can have strategies that look very similar, right? Like I can have an alternatives portfolio that's invested in real estate X percent, and that can look similar to an investment allocation for someone who's, you know, got $50 million. You know, maybe they have 10% invested in real estate. I can do the same thing. I can put 10% in real estate. I can go into real estate alternatives. So I can make what I'm doing look similar to what they're doing. Just they're doing it a lot. There's a team that goes behind that. So the way private wealth management works is there's you know, one person who's got a book of clients and they get paid off of how that book of clients performs, right? So they'll get a percentage, you know, call it 75 bips, so 0.75 of a percent of whatever that person, let's call it $100 million under management for Jerry, who made a soap company, right? So Jerry's got $100 million. I'm making 75 bips off of that. And I'm going to put Jerry in the positions where I think like we can capitalize on, you know, macroeconomic, you know, macro this, you know, derivatives, blah, 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 blah. Like, and I'm doing that as I'm the person who's managing that relationship. But behind the scenes, there's a team of people whose job is to look at Jerry's asset, like what he's currently invested in, what his risk tolerance is, how old he is, where he's located, what industries he's in, like, and to say, okay, I think this is the strategy we should go for. We should increase his allocation here. We should, you know, take a little bit of risk off the table here. And then there's even other people who are building those products to do tax loss harvesting, for example, because for someone with 100 million AUM, tax loss harvesting is a big deal. For someone who's got, you know, a million AUM, it's a big deal, but it's less of a big deal, right? Like these are big strategies and these are complicated things people are doing. And also they're bringing in experts, they're bringing in trust T&E lawyers, so trust and estate lawyers, accountants, like they're taking into account massive, you know, the tax implications of everything are always taken into account for people with significant AUM, and always looking for tax advantage strategies, you know. So let's say I have a bunch of Pepsi stock. I want to sell, and we think that the, you know, there's a bunch of legislation. We for whatever reason we get bearish on sodas. Well, let me sell some Pepsi. And then 30 days, you know, 20 days later, all of a sudden, you know, they take a dip and now they're coming back up. Okay, I'm gonna buy some Coke so I can tax loss harvest or whatever. Like, there's different strategies for dealing with stuff that just kind of is above and beyond what your average person is doing, because those are very bespoke things. Like Charles Schwab can't sell a bespoke tax advantage strategy to your average pilot because everyone's got these different profiles. And there's just a lot of paperwork involved in that. There's a lot of accounting. You have to keep track of all these things. So there's a team behind these people. And, you know, people with billions and billions of dollars, they have family offices. There's, you know, 10, 15 people whose entire, they get paid a lot of money to just manage that family's money. And that's their entire purpose. So, you know, there's things we can do as pilots and people who aren't, you know, multi-millionaires to get ourselves to the point where we have several million AUM so that we can, you know, spit off 5% a year and live comfortably in retirement and figure out, you know, what do we want for our inheritance? I mean, that's the other part is there's, you know, those teeny lawyers, they're setting up trusts. They're doing a lot of estate planning. And those are things that we should all be, after I did that internship, I started really looking into, all right, I need to be cognizant of, you know, if I ever get lucky enough to make a shitload of money, you know, how am I going to manage that? How do I want to approach that? Because those are tough conversations. Some people are like, oh, I'm going to give it all to Jimmy. And meanwhile, you know, Jimmy's over here like with a hooker problem and like snorting cocaine and all this, you know, Jimmy's got his own set of problems. He's achieved very little in life, but his dad thinks he's just an angel and wants to give him $20 million, right? So, you know, how do you protect Jimmy? How do you protect the dad? So there's just big teams behind these people. A lot of it is just knowing the rules.
Yeah, I think that's why we've got this podcast, right? Is so that we can bring those kind of people on and sort of democratize access to that information for people that can't, you know, that don't have $100 million and can't, you know, leverage these big teams one-on-one. Ryan, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, for the first officer out there who just got their gig at the majors, or maybe they're at the regional starting, and they're thinking, I don't have $20 million. I don't have $1 million. Hell, I just broke six-figure income the first time this year. What's the first move that person should be making as they're beginning their transition to maybe ending a career with several million dollars in retirement or getting them in a position to do that? You know, what they don't have the benefit of Harvard. They don't have the benefit of these fancy hedge fund managers. You know, what are they doing today actionable to start getting on that path, that journey? What resources do they have available?
YouTube. So get smart on what is a 401k, what is an IRA, get into the actual IRS regulations. I have an Excel spreadsheet that I use that every year I update all the tax brackets, all the contribution limits. And I have a rough idea of how much I'm going to pay in taxes. So if I have a big tax, if I see in my spreadsheet, hey, you've got a big tax liability coming up, I need to set aside some cash, because otherwise I'm pumping that right into my retirement and sending it right into the market.
And what?
So get.
Yeah, real quick. What? Give me five searches. You know, they're on Google. They're about to YouTube something. What would you say that they should put in for keywords? Sorry to interrupt. I just really trying to make it applicable.
Like, what is a 401k? What is an IRA? What is a, what's the college? 529. What is a 529 plan? It's clearly, I need to Google that.
<It's all good. laughs>
Let's see what else. Five other things. Inheritance and gift giving rules. You can gift, I think this year is like $19,000. For any person without being taxed by the IRS, your lifetime giving is like $4 or $5 million. So understanding that, so that you can help your parents as they're retiring, as your parents to think about their, basically like become an expert on these rules, right? And let's see, what's the fifth? I'll think of the fifth. But yeah, your 401k started, get an IRA started. And I put that money in. A lot of people are like, oh, the end of the year is coming up, I better make my contribution. Like, why the hell would you do that? It should be January 1st you make the contribution, so you get a whole year of that stuff accruing and investing, right? So at the beginning of every year, I immediately fill up my IRA instantly and let that thing start taking off. And then I look at my projected earnings for the year, any self-employed employment income and start like shoving money in as much as I can for self-employment. So understand the limits of like, when you go into this 401k, like if I'm doing side hustles, which most pilots are, how can I take as much of that self-employment income and shove that into a tax advantaged account? How, you know, what is a backdoor? What are my contribution limits across all my retirement plans? And how do I keep track of what is going from my paycheck into my, employer sponsored plan? What are my elective contributions? What are my non-elective contributions? Like how much can I contribute as an employer? Tax, like what is a pass-through entity for all your side hustles? What are the tax implications of that? So just getting smart on all these terms. And then getting the mindset of like, you are not going to outsmart your average person on Wall Street. So stick with the basics, index investing, dollar cost averaging. Oh yeah, dollar cost averaging. Google that. That's number five.
Boom.
And we'll make sure that these all get in the show notes as well. So if you're awesome. Want to reference the show later on, we'll put your top. Sounds like we got 10 searches for Google.
Yeah.
No, one quick follow-up. Is there any talking head or pundit that you follow that, you know, is a good speaker or author that you say, hey, that would be your guy to get started with?
I don't, because I think that can go down a lot of those people are going down the road of like, hey, this is Jim Cramer here. Here's my top stock picks. And like every huckster's got their sell. And so I just try to stay clear of that environment. Like, let me stick to the basics.
Good advice.
ETFs.
Great advice.
ETFs or some actively managed fund, and be careful about your actively, like, look at what you're currently invested in. Like I said, when I was financially illiterate, USA was like, hey, we'll do your investing for you. You have to, like, you know, $200,000, however much I had saved up. I was like, okay, cool. That's awesome. And then I got to Goldman and saw the conversations going. And I was like, wait, what the shit? And I called USA and was like, what's been the return on this? They're like, well, it's exceeded our benchmark by 1.2%. I'm like, what's your benchmark? And they're like, oh, it's an internal benchmark. I'm like, what's its performance versus the S&P? And they're like, and just like went hard, like right in the face of this person. And they're like, basically I found out that my portfolio had been returning like 2% a year and the market had been returning eight. And I was like, I will withdraw all my money right now from you. And I'm taking control of this, because they just had me stuffed in all these actively managed funds. And then they were taking a fee off of that. So it's just like fee city, everyone scratching each other's backs, just like taking money out of my pocket. And like, they made me feel like I was being taken care of, but I wasn't. So be knowledgeable about how is the market performing? How is your portfolio performing? And who are the people you're invested in? Like, actively managed funds can do really well, but they can also just be actively managed. And it's just some like jerk off ETF that doesn't really do much other than like mimic some sector. And now you're just paying 1-2% fees on top of that when it should be, you know, 5 bips or 10 bips maybe.
I really want to pull on this thread really badly, because you started the conversation with, I went to Harvard. What I learned is that people with lots of money hire very smart, savvy people who have a comprehensive team that looks at their entire investment strategy from tax, estate, tax loss harvesting, you know, and charges a fee, right? And that's a good thing, because they're giving them to these financial savants to manage their portfolio and have a quarterback. But then contradict that to maybe what you would find, like you said, with USAA, where it's like active fund, and nobody's got your best interest and they're charging all these fees. Let's talk about the differences there, because I think that's where there's some confusion, right? Where you hear the rich and the wealthy are just giving all their money and management to the smarter, but you also have that option available to you as a less wealthy individual. Talk up through those differences, because I think it's really important to understand that. Because I got really frustrated when I was a regional pilot, I stuffed a bunch of money into my 401k, maxed it out every year. And then I was giving it to an advisor when I left the airline, when I went to go have a managed account. And then I was like, wait, you're charging like 2% of my money? And then it's going, whether it goes up or down, it doesn't matter. And I got really frustrated, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, speak to that a little bit if you don't mind.
Yeah. I mean, there's two words. One's bespoke and the other one's fiduciary. So, you know, USA, mm-hmm. like that, the dude from, you know, the neighborhood wealth manager is not necessarily a fiduciary. I think now they'd passed that law 3-4 years ago about everyone having to be a fiduciary. That wasn't the case back when.
Which was wild. It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You mean you, you didn't have to have your client's best interest in mind before they passed that law.
Exactly. And so like, and also when the market starts to like USAA doesn't, when it's not Goldman Sachs, right? Like everyone knows who Goldman Sachs is. I got the water bottle right here, right? Like everyone knows who Goldman Sachs is. It is like the top of the pyramid for finances in many aspects, right? So USAA is not going to match the talent on that. Like, and the to the bespoke word, right? No one, when Goldman thinks, hey, we've got some questions in the market or there's a sector we think, you know, here's how we're going to take some money out of here and we're going to reallocate it over here. USAA is not going to be proactive. They're not going to see recession coming, or they're not going to say, hey, Austin, you know, we saw that you're, you know, overly indexed in this sector and we're not very bullish on the sector anymore. So we're going to go ahead and we'd like to move your money out of this sector and into this other. Like, what are your thoughts about this investment? Like, those are conversations that people with lots of money are having, because by doing that, their investors are going to make a lot of money, right? Because it's you know, I get a slice of whatever they make. But USA, if they're making money no matter what, if it's just based on AUM, then they're just taking money out of me no matter what, not based on performance. So it's too hard. You cannot do that at scale. USA cannot have hundreds of thousands of people that they serve, and they cannot offer a bespoke solution. So that's where the onus becomes on our shoulders to say, all right, there is some degree of active management that I could be doing. Whether or not I should be doing it is another question. And what actively managed strategies and investments do I want to make? Like, where do I want to put my money? Like, how much actively do I want to manage it? And am I going to be making a better decision than my alternative? And what is my best alternative, right? Like, you guys do real estate investing, right? Like,
big time.
best use, right? Highest and best use. What is my highest, like, what is my best alternative? What's the bat in here? Like, is there someone else who's a really great investor who wants to like manage my like peanuts? Or, you know, so that those are the questions, like, what environment am I operating in? What are my alternatives? And so those are the big differences, right? Like, those incentives can be great when they're managed properly, when you have the right managers with the right team and the right strategy. But when it's just like, hey, park your money here, we're going to charge you X percent, that they don't always have your best interest in mind. Even now, even after that fiduciary stuff, it's not going to case, because it's simply not scalable. You cannot address the needs of hundreds of thousands of clients.
I think the word there is singular focus, right? When you walk into like a Chase branch and there's the guy in the back who catches wind that you got $100,000 in your account, that guy's going to come at you and sell you something with a singular focus, right?
Yeah.
A certain product, a certain placement, right? Because that's how Chase or any one of these bigger financial institutions makes their money. So thank you. That's a great perspective.
Yeah. And you always see like the CPC and a lot of these Chase, and you're like, oh, who gets to go behind that door? And there's varying levels, right? Like, CPC is lower than JP Morgan private banking, because when CPC people get to be too big, they just go up to the big leagues into private banking. Now they're getting, you know, private jet flight, you know, they're getting flown out to New York to have a meeting with the team.
And so, for those that don't know what that is, CPC is Chase Private Client. So if you've got over $100,000, I think is what it is, or I don't know what the threshold is, actually pretty low for Chase.
I think it's 250 or
okay.
I don't know what it is. I don't know CPC.
Whatever it is, but you now you're in a category, right, where you maybe get some more benefits. You might get, you know, city passes to museums and some benefits for free. So it might be even be worth looking into some of the benefits of banking with certain branches and what they give you and privilege and access. So,
and I've had these conversations with classmates from Harvard who are all, you know, they're all making more money than I am right now. Like, guys making $500 million a year. And even some of them don't use private client banking because they're like, I don't see the value. Like, all my friends who are in banking, they don't use private banking. They just do it themselves. And they all, every single one of them to the T, does index investing. And that's not just because legally they're not allowed to do anything else, but even they will acknowledge, like, I do this for a living and I don't have the time or the expertise to invest in specific stocks. So most of them do index investing.
I think for me, and quickly just to touch on the private banking thing, I mean, that also assumes that you're going to leave that much cash sitting in account, right? Because, I think for
it's
a lot
AUM.
Of people, that doesn't make sense. Right.
So they're not going to care that you have, you know, however much money. If you have $500,000 of turbine, they don't give a shit about that. Like,
right,
their threshold is, how much money are you going to give me?
Right. And is that, would that be cash in an account, or would that be invested in the market?
It's just cash on their books.
Cash, right.
Whether whether it's cash or whether it's securities or whatever it is, they just want that, those dollars under their roof.
Right.
On deposit. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Got it. Well, I think the key word for me there was incentive and incentive alignment, right? I mean, you look at it, to compare this with properties, you know, you look at the incentive of a property manager when you have a fourplex or a single family home, and you have a property manager that's taking 8 or 10% of the rents, that might be $120 a month. Like, how hard are you going to work for $120 a month? And it's the same thing with wealth management, right? Yeah. When you have a 500 unit apartment complex or a massive storage facility, and you're making, you know, well into five figures, you know, which is decent for a property manager, right? Or even six, you're going to, you know, get a whole different caliber of person and a whole different caliber of attention, right? So,
yep.
And just looking for incentive alignment when you're placing your money.
Yeah, it's skin in the game, right? And you're getting more. And that was another great thing we learned at school is who performs better, franchises or corporate owned? In a place where you have franchises right. all the time. Because yep. people have more skin in the game.
Right. They care.
Yep.
Yep. I love that. Well, hey, we're getting towards the end of our time. I want to kind of bring this full circle. One of the questions I wanted to ask you was, what does discipline mean to you? You know, you're a guy who's achieved an incredible amount in your life. You are giving back in some incredible ways. You've been through, the academy. You've been through Harvard. You've done interns at Goldman Sachs. What does discipline mean to you? And what lessons can you impart on other people in terms of how to sort of hack that to better their lives?
You know, I think one thing is, from my point of view, discipline is siloed. So, you know, you could have someone who's at the gym who's disciplined every day about working out and makes horrible financial decisions. So discipline is a very siloed skill set. So because you're disciplined in one thing doesn't mean it's going to transfer over into others. So you have to make discipline in like every aspect of your life. You know, and it always starts small. So, you know, the making the bed thing, right? Like I try to do, you can't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to completely change my life without starting with little small things. And that's how you build the successes and create that positive, you know, reinforcement feedback loop. So, you know, you just have to start small. If your goal is to be more, you want to be more in better shape, right? But you're just like, hey, I'm grinding down. I'm a new first officer and I'm like flying all the time and find those little opportunities. Like, hey, I just, you know, flight's not ready to board. I'm going to go out to the jet bridge and do like 20 air squats. Or, you know, when I get down on the tarmac, I'm going to knock out like 20 pushups. Like just do small things. Like when I was during the pandemic right here, every hour on the hour, I would do 20 pushups and then 20 sit-ups. And then the next week I would do 25 and the next week I'd do 30. And then I would add squats and other things and just start with like little small steps to like set yourself on the right course. And just recognize that it goes with eating. You have to do that separately for your diet. You have to do it for your finances. So don't just think like, oh man, I started doing pushups, so now everything else is going to fall in place. Because it's hard. It takes work, you know, all the time. We all, you know, use discipline when we're flying. And we're pretty good at it there, but clearly we're not, right. You know, based on some of the bodies I see, deadheading, you know, yeah. Not everyone is disciplined across all areas. And, you know,
that'd be like a whole other podcast.
Yeah. I'd be a lot richer right now if I were better financially, if I had more financial discipline back in the day. Right. So, doing small things like just Googling and reading about IRAs one day and just getting smart about that. And then the next day, read about 401ks. Just do little small things to create positive like feedback loops. And then just set a calendar. Like I live and die off my calendar and my to-do list. So, you know, reminders on Apple devices, like it's not the best, you know, it's not the best app by any stretch of the imagination, but it's on everything I have. It's on my laptop. It's on this. So if there's something I need to do, I can type it out on my phone and then it'll pop up on my computer and remind me to do that. Calendars as well. Calendars, from my opinion, is the key to actually doing more things, right? Like, if you want to go on a vacation, put it on your calendar. because then you're going to see it and you're going to be like, all right, I need to buy tickets. And it becomes more of a reality when you put it on the calendar. For the same reason people don't start running until they sign up for a marathon, right? Like, put it on the calendar and you're going to start solving for that. You're going to start indexing for that.
You know what I love about what you just said is it's like 20 pushups or 10 pushups. Like you said a lot, right? You have a lot of different things like calendar and fitness and when you're at the JetBridge or whatever, but really you could just do one thing a day. Like you don't have to do all those things all at once. Like what you didn't say was go spend 4 hours at the gym or 3 hours at the gym or do all this complicated eating. You know, you can just do bite-sized discipline that will eventually add up to a whole life that is meaningful and impactful and disciplinary actions that make you successful. So really appreciate you hearing that.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Love that. Well, Austin, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it. I know we've spent, almost an hour here. Thank you. I think we've gotten a ton of value for everyone. How can people find out more about you? And is there anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
Just live every day, man. Like, make sure that you're living your life purposefully. Because if you do that, if you take that attitude, everything else kind of will fall in place. I was talking with a classmate last night, actually, who said he started journaling this year. He said, every day I just write down one thing that's positive about the day. And it's really changed my mindset. And I'm going to start doing that because all it takes is that little mindset shift. And Ryan, as you pointed out, you start doing 20 crunches or 20 Eric squats in the JetBridge. The next thing you know, you're like, you know what? I need to start doing more. There's a gym near my house. I'm going to start going for 30 minutes a day. And you're going to solve the problems. You're going to come up with your solutions for yourself. All you need is just a little nudge in the beginning. So,
absolutely.
I love that.
Thanks so much, Austin. Yeah, this has been fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Absolutely.